Welcome to the Humble Hoof Podcast. My name is Alicia Harlov. This is a podcast for both horse owners and hoof care professionals, offering discussions into various philosophies on the health of the hoof and soundness of your horse. Please check us out on Facebook or at thehumblehoof.com.
Trying to choose the right supplements for the right horses often feels like a chore, and you have enough chores as it is. Fortunately, there's Equithrive, whose mission is to make this whole nutrition equation easier on you and much more beneficial to your horses. Equithrive's lineup of pelleted supplements are developed with care, backed by science, and 100% satisfaction guarantee. Not to mention picky eater approved. Whether you need advanced joint care for your equine athlete, gut or metabolic support, Equithrive is your one-stop shop for feed tub fortification. Do your horses and yourself a favor and visit equithrive.com. Use the promo code HumbleHoof and get 20% off your first order, plus free and fast shipping nationwide. Don't forget to use HumbleHoof, all one word, to get 20% off your first order at equithrive.com.
A special thank you to our wonderful sponsor, Cavallo. For our Humble Hoof listeners, they are offering 20% off their Cavallo Trek hoof boots using the coupon code HRN at checkout. The Trek is the world's most popular and versatile hoof boot and Cavallo's toughest trail boot, while also doubling as an option for therapy or rehab. The front closure system makes it easily adaptable to various hoof shapes, and the TPU upper design allows for maximum strength while minimizing weight for the comfort and ease of movement for your horse. These are recommended by vets and trainers and also loved as transport boots by barrel racers, show jumpers, dressage riders, and everyone in between. Again, for 20% off a pair of Treks, use the code HRN at checkout at cavallo-inc.com. When I first found Bonnie Nealon's website, I was just super interested in the fact that she's seen so many feral equine feet around the world, and the different environments they're in, and how that affects their soundness, and how that affects how their hoof looks, and how they move over various terrain. I wanted to talk to her about what she's seen on feral horses and their hooves versus domestic horses, and what that means for how we approach these horses in terms of trimming and hoof care. So why don't we start, and can you tell us a little bit about kind of your journey into what you do now? Like, how did you get started with the Touching Wilds?
Yeah, I certainly can, although I tend to go on a bit. So sorry if it's not a little introduction. So like many of us, I've been obsessed with horses my entire life. And when I got the opportunity to train as an equine podiatrist, I thought all my dreams had come true to get an opportunity to work with horses and spend time with people who really care and are invested in looking after their horses, which you tend to find in the barefoot world, particularly, I think. When I first started training, it was way back in the early 2000s. I qualified in 2005 as an EP. And we didn't have the best of reputations at that point. It was a new thing on the scene. There was some not so great stuff happening. And we all tended to get lumped in together as a sort of a negative lunatic fringe of hoof care. So that in itself had a lot of challenges. But working as an EP, I have to say, and I say this a lot to people, is the best job in the world. It's such a great way to be with horses and people who care about them. So I really enjoyed my work, and living in a remote place, having a young family, it wasn't that easy logistically. But I worked in the domestic horse world for probably about 15 years, but always specialising and enjoying working with horses that had labels like dangerous or difficult or problem horses. And I found that I loved the allowing the time for them to build confidence and to be able to ultimately get them to trust me enough to let them trim their feet in whatever way that might be. And this led me into being asked to work with a group of semi-feral, sort of unhandled, free-living ponies on a remote island off the west coast of Scotland. And when I went to that place, I have to say I was feeling reasonably confident in my abilities. I'd been quite successful. I think with all the horses I'd worked with, I'd ultimately been able to trim them. And I sort of had a method and a way of approaching things. And I may have been a little bit full of myself when I went. And thankfully, that was completely blown apart as soon as I met these ponies. So there were lots of challenges. The logistics of getting there was a big deal. There was very limited facilities. There was a huge range of behaviour. There was about 40 of them, and some had been really badly treated, and I would even say traumatised, and not, I'm not using that word lightly. They were so terrified of people that their behaviour was very extreme. And then at the other end of the scale, there was completely unhandled horses. So it was this sort of incredible opportunity to work with a wide range. But what I discovered very quickly was that all of my tried and tested methods did not work. And not only did they not work, they made things worse. So I had this experience. I suppose it was an epiphany, although at the time it felt like it felt a lot harder and darker than that. But at the time, I realised that what I was doing was not working. So very quickly, I decided that I'd just stop everything I was following and just start again. I spent time observing their behaviour, seeing how they were interacting with each other. And I tried my best to use elements of that to interact with them. And what I discovered was that quite quickly, I was actually trimming feet and working with them in a way I hadn't thought was possible. There really were very limited and very unsafe and sort of rickety type facilities. So it wasn't like before where I'd had, you know, arenas or round pens or stables or sort of places that the horses really have no choice but to be with you. In this place, that wasn't the case. So it forced upon me this different way of working with them. But what that did was led me down the path of following their lead. So when I talk about my work now, it's horse-led work, and that looks different in different places with different horses. So it's more of an approach than a method. And these days I do a little bit of work in the domestic horse world. I have my own horses as well at home. But mainly I'm working with regenerative grazing herds in zoos, wildlife parks with wild equids. And I also take groups of people to wild places to study free living horses, because I think the best way that we can learn about horse behaviour is from the experts, and the experts are horses. But just to sort of be really clear about this, horses who live life on their own terms behave very differently to our domestic horses. So if we don't see that and recognise that and begin to get familiar with that, we don't have our baseline. And I think we're really missing that in domestication. So we need to have this blueprint, this understanding of who they are without us, you know, what they've the animal they've evolved to be, because then we can use that information in the domestic horse world to improve their lives. So that, I hope, wasn't too long, but that's sort of a quick journey of where I started and where I've got to now.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, it was very fascinating to me, especially because I have been a Mustang enthusiast for the last 10 mm-hmm. years or so. And I fully admit to everybody who I talk to that I am not in any way a trainer. But I have my own Mustang that was, you know, rounded up from the wild in 2008. And I had, there was a border of mine that adopted a feral Mustang last year, and I've been able to follow his progress over the last year. And the horse that the riding accident I actually got in last week was on a newly started Mustang. I did not start that horse. But yeah, they're, you know, definitely a passion of mine. And so, you know, seeing that you've worked so much with these horses, I just thought it would be really cool to talk about some differences you've noticed. And obviously we focus a lot on hoof health and soundness. So that's going to be kind of like the main avenue I'm kind of getting at, but obviously mm-hmm. there's a lot more that goes into that than just their feet in terms of their health and how they're able to function. So obviously, you know, I'm happy to hear about all the different things you've noticed. But I think one of the first things that I want to bring up is that, you know, when we see these silly debates online about hoof care, a lot of times people will bring up the fact that our domesticated horses aren't feral, they aren't wild, and we can't trim them or treat them the way you would a horse in the wild. And I know that's kind of like a broad statement, but I would love your thoughts on that in terms of, with your observing so many different horses, both feral and in these, you know, wild environments and domesticated horses, what are some of the main differences you see between the two hoof-wise?
Well, it's really interesting because I see such a variety of different feet, and it just depends on the habitat they're in. So to give you two examples, two extreme examples, last year I was lucky enough to go to the Gobi Desert in Mongolia to study the Taki, who are the Chevalsky, Equus Chevalsky, and also living wild in the Gobi Desert are the Kulan, which are the Asiatic wild ass. And it's the only place in the world where the two actually live together in the wild. So many fascinating things to see there, but that was one area of interest I was particularly interested in. And while we were there, we came across a carcass of a Kulan, and I got many photos of the feet because I obviously that was really the first thing I looked at. And I could get really close and I could handle the feet, and they felt like silk. They were so abraded by the desert surface. So there's lots of very small stones, and they're traveling vast distances, these animals, and often at speed as well. And the shape that had been sculpted by these conditions is what we would consider broken back pastern angle or a negative palmar angle, the very low heels and a long toe. But obviously these feet are high performance feet. They're doing, I mean, at least I would say 20 miles a day, covering a huge area trying to find food and water. And like I said, often very, very fast as well. Whenever we saw them, they were going at a very fast trot or cantering as quickly as possible away. So I think that, along with lots of other things that I've seen, just makes me question this idea of the being an ideal foot. I think the desert conditions sculpted the feet, and certainly the horse feet, the wild horse feet, were different. They were more like the ones that you might see that are used in the Mustang model. So they had a higher heel and, again, just really well abraded surfaces. But they're fit for purpose. You know, they're fit for that environment, that habitation and the surface that they're covering. And in another place, I work with horses who live almost constantly in a marsh or boggy, wet conditions. And their feet are like duck plates, you know, duck feet. They're like soup plates because they, I imagine, are spreading to disperse the weight. So they do very, very well in that habitat. And like the Camargue horses as well, you know, you always see those photos of them galloping through the water. And I often try and do close-ups on the feet because I haven't managed to get there yet. But their feet are adapting very well to the environment they're in. But of course, the problem comes when we take them out of that and expect them to perform in or to be sound on a harder surface. So what I see consistently is feet, healthy functioning feet for whatever unique environment they might live in. And I think it just confirms something that I've thought for many years working with domestic horses, that it can be a bit of a straitjacket if we get too focused on ideal angles, you know, the perfect foot, because there's different types of foot conformation. You know, if you've dissected a lot of legs, you'll know that you can get different shaped pedal bones. And if the hoof is being shaped by the inner structure of the bone, then that's going to give us a different look to the outer capsule. So do we want them all to look the same? Do we want to set these rigid perimeters to give us this proper, what we think is a proper foot? So I think, I love to think that people are bringing in a hefty dose of common sense with this stuff, and really wonder if maybe the first question we should ask is, are these feet fit for purpose? And they might not look beautiful, but are they functional? And are they keeping the horse sound? Because ultimately, that's the most important thing, is the horse able to do what they need to do? And are they comfortable doing it? So I think that's sort of the overriding sort of message I've got from all the different types of feet I've seen in all the different places. There's not one ideal model. Certainly, some look very beautiful, and certainly in the drier, more abrasive conditions, that the feet there tend to be wonderful. But as I said, with the Kulan example, that blew my mind a bit, because I've always thought the structure at the back of the foot is very important, which of course it is. But in that particular environment and habitat, that was a high functioning foot. So keeping an open mind, being flexible, knowing what a healthy foot looks like, but also then taking in the individual circumstances of the horse and blending this all together to come up with what works for them. So I don't know if that answers your question, because really there's so many different types of feet that I could talk about, but that's the overriding thing, just the adaptation to the environment.
Having a hoof rehab facility, one main focus of ours is forage. I want the horses here to have safe, tested forage available 24/7 without the risk of becoming obese. I've spent years looking for the ideal slow feeder for us, and we have found it with Hay Boss feeders. When I tell you that my Hay Boss XL feeder has cut my feeding time by 90%, I mean it, and it might even be an understatement. The covered feeders with integrated slow feed nets allow for all my horses here to have access to hay all the time, which is healthy for their guts and minds. They're also not able to completely binge all at once because the nets keep them in check. They're available all over North America right now, but side note, if you're in New England, I got mine from Mountain Lane Farm, who delivered it right to me and showed us how to set it up and use it. We can't imagine our lives without it here. Yeah, and I think that's such an interesting observation, especially because I think that being a hoof care provider can be very humbling, in the sense that I feel like I'm fairly new to this game. I've only been trimming for, 10 years or so, and this has only been my full-time career for the last 6, but I've been repeatedly, I've repeatedly had to step back and allow feet to do things that I don't necessarily think looks perfect or symmetrical or not healthy, but doesn't look what we think of as the ideal foot, in order Absolutely. To see that horse become comfortable and sound. And I've seen horses become much more sound when I stop trying to force my ideas on their feet. And it's hard. Something that I've always struggled with is that, there can be people that have horses with the most beautiful looking feet and their horse is lame, and everybody will compliment whoever is doing the feet. But then if you have somebody come in who might just kind of let the foot take its own ideas and the horse is sound, people will say, oh my goodness, your hoof care provider, your farrier, your trimmer is terrible. Look how terrible those feet look. And something that I've tried to do on my, Facebook page is just open up discussions of, that same idea that you're talking about, that is there really an ideal foot? Are we, should we be forcing our ideas on the hoof if it's not allowing the horse to be comfortable? And then I guess something that I still grapple with is, if a horse is comfortable now because we're letting the feet change and adapt to something that is not textbook, will that cause issues down the road? Like, should we try to force them to some ideal because, some research says that biomechanically XYZ should be correct? And that's something that I still am not sure about,
Yeah. I have to say, I'm with you. I think these questions need to be asked and continue to be asked. And I think as soon as we feel like we've got the answers, then that's probably a massive red flag, and we need to have a really serious look at what we're doing, because I don't think there are hard and fast rules. And I think that our ideal feet for that horse in that environment at that time. So we've got to take so much into consideration when we as hoof care providers, so that we can enable the horse to meet the needs of usually what the owner wants from them. But sometimes it's just quality of life, you know, just keeping them comfortable enough.
Right.
And yeah. that certainly is, yeah, and that I think for me, because I've moved more into the area of behavior, I'm doing my master's in equine science at the moment, specializing in behavior, and feet and behavior are my two obsessions. But even when I was a full-time EP, the question I would always ask first is the horse comfortable? And it wouldn't be, you know, it should look like this or that it should be able to do that. I am a lifetime student. I think as the day I stop wanting to go and do courses, that will be my last day, because I love learning. So I've gone off and done equine body work and studying anatomy and physiology and all these reasons, biomechanics, to get my head around all of this. And what I see is that it's really important to do that. I think it's really important to have a very grounded knowledge of functional anatomy and movement and all the rest of it. But I think it can come, we need to be very careful, because that can come with a bit of a tunnel vision. You know, when you understand a bit about biomechanics or you look at conformation, you start to see things that need correcting. But always, 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 we need to be asking the horse. It's the horse's body. Is it okay for us to be going in and changing their body? In a small number of cases, yes. If you're looking at rehab after injury, then actually things like the passive physio that Sharon May Davis suggests, you know, things like that could be really useful. Sometimes we do need to physically change their feet for a period of time so that we can improve. So after laminitis, for example, you know, we need to make sure the toes don't get away on them to help them regrow a healthy hoof capsule. But generally, I think the answers need to come from the horses. So we need to learn and to be more open to taking a step back and seeing what they're offering us, learning what they are trying to express to us, whether that's pain or discomfort, which, you know, is, there's a lot more information about that these days, and we're tuning ourselves into it. But something that I'm passionate about is research into friendships and happiness, and what does that look like in horses? You know, we know the pain phase scale, and we know Sue Dyson's ridden horse pain ethogram, things like that. But getting to know our horse's baseline of homeostasis, of sort of neutrality and happiness, that's important. And going along with them, you know, trying things. It's not to say don't do anything. Try things, but use the feedback from them. And I think if we can balance this sort of, this intellectual cleverness that we have with an openness to learning from the animals themselves, then I think there's a sweet spot in the middle of those two things. So we can bring this skill and this knowledge into what we're doing with them, but we're not enforcing things on them because we think it's right. Because I know I've done that in the past. And then further down the line, I've regretted it. It has actually ultimately been the wrong thing. And it can be a steep learning curve and a difficult process sometimes. But I think just not looking at, particularly at the static sort of, or even gait analysis, you know, even sort of breaking it down. It's such a scientific sort of deconstructing of the animal itself, themselves. Whereas if we're looking at their behavior and we know them as individuals, I think that information should be as important, if not more important, when we're making these decisions. So I don't know if that was a clear answer, but it's something I think a lot of. And I think it's good to bring our skill and our knowledge. But I think, I know my own experience. I am completely, constantly humbled by situations, particularly to do with horses. Usually when words come out my mouth, like, it's definitely going to be like this, or that will never happen. That's usually a right. sign something's going to change.
Absolutely. And actually, something that you mentioned, I'm really curious about, is you said that some horses in different environments, you see their feet adapt to that environment. And are there any commonalities that you see, for example, you know, very wet environments? I know that you mentioned that the feet were more like duck feet. Are there some commonalities that you see on similar environments where the horses seem to be the most sound if their feet are a certain way that you can kind of speak to on that note?
I would say that the key thing that I've seen is always to do with nutrition. It's always to do with what they're actually eating as well. And very often in these free living environments, they have a huge range of plant species to choose from. And even though there can be variations in the sort of the anatomy of the foot or the physical look of the foot, it can be more to do with how quickly the feet grow. You know, if there is a problem, how quickly does that resolve? But I have to say, one thing that is consistent in all of the populations that I study is I'm struggling now to even think of lame horses, and certainly not any with a prolonged lameness. So I would be reluctant to sort of say there's any one particular characteristic or set of characteristics. But if the nutrition's there, they're traveling over varied surfaces. It seems like when they're youngsters, you know, the development of those feet is just phenomenal, and they're set up for life. So that seems to be the key thing. If it's horses that have maybe been turned out, maybe not even brought up as domestic horses, but maybe in a more domestic setting, but then put out onto to bigger ranges or into conservation areas, they can sometimes develop problems and their feet just don't seem as strong. So, you know, just as speculation, I would tie that in with their early life experiences. So, I think different habitats, different breeds as well, the different types of shapes of feet that I see, I think... I haven't got a clear answer for you on that one, I'm afraid.
Yeah, that's okay. And I agree with you too about the biggest things I've seen impact the soundness of a horse is diet and movement. And that's a huge reason why I put track systems up on my property, because I don't have hundreds and hundreds of acres to let horses just free roam. And, you know, the track system has various surfaces and different areas of different kinds of forage. And I've seen huge improvements in hooves, but I agree that, you know, if they're not getting that from a young age, we're kind of starting with a less, like a lesser potential as they're older. I guess this is obviously a speculation since I don't think we have any studies on this, but do you put much stock then in the genetics? I know that obviously different breeds are going to have different, you know, for example, I was saying to somebody yesterday that a cob is going to most likely have thicker walls than a thoroughbred. But in terms of hoof health, do you see genetics playing a large role, or do you think that the movement and the diet is playing more of a role, or what are your thoughts on that?
I would say not really. In domestication, for sure. You know, if I am asked to trim a cob feet and I'm asked to trim thoroughbred feet, I have two different reactions. I mean, thoroughbreds have been bred for everything other than, they've been bred for one thing, and everything else I think has fallen by the wayside. You know, speed is the only thing that matters. And cobs are, you know, they're so underrated. They have such fantastic feet. And generally, you know that you're going to be onto a winner when you're dealing with cob feet. And thoroughbred feet can be a little bit more complex. But equally, if you set things up, the changes can happen. I think genetics play a part for sure, but I think it's a small part. I think, again, the early life experiences, if the structures are developed by use, like the animal is not just sort of doing distances or speed or whatever, but varied terrain, you know, all the little ligaments within the hoof capsule are strong, the digital cushion is getting built up and is robust. That is a big factor, and I think the genetics can play a role in as much that some animals can start off with you know, a few steps ahead, perhaps, because their feet are genetically good. But in the environment, when they have the time to develop good feet, they consistently do. And that's, I mean, the other thing, of course, with free living horses is they're not being asked to do anything. So they are choosing how they move, when they move. They don't have the extra weight of a rider on top. So their feet adapt brilliantly to the habitat they're in, given the time to develop. So it plays a role, but I would say not a big role. And I think other factors are as important for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess this question might seem a little bit off topic, but, you know, talking about the free living horses, if they're in a more wet environment, do you see them struggling on harder surfaces because they live in a wet environment? Or do you think that's more sort of how they're, I don't even know, you know, how they're kept in domestication?
Yeah, I see them struggling on softer surfaces for sure. Yeah. I mean, it depends on how wet the environment is and, you know, how long they're in spending time with their feet immersed in wet conditions. I think any change in environment is going to affect the horse in some way. So, for example, there's one place that has a lot of very wet ground, very marshy, and sometimes horses are brought into that place. And when they come, quite often their hooves are quite short. So to start with, when these horses go out on this marsh, they're sort of sinking down and they're struggling to move over the surface. And that that can be quite detrimental for them. But they, you know, their feet will change and adapt. And quite quickly you see them sort of moving over the surface of the ground. You know, the weight dispersion of the feet has changed again, they've adapted to this habitat. But when they've got those feet and then they come off onto harder ground, you know, they're used to the soft conditions. Very often they don't have much of a frog. And they won't necessarily go lame or be really sore, but there's a change to their movement and it will take time for those feet to adapt back. So it really depends. And my own horses, I live in a very wet place on the west coast of Scotland. And I've just sort of resigned myself to not having the best frogs in the world. I'd rather they were out in a big hill field moving around in wet conditions than I have tried bringing them in and having them, be on tracks or on a drier surface to improve their feet. And it does work. But the management that goes into that is a lot. So my compromise is to use boots. And I mean, the boots we have these days are just so fantastic. When I first started out, oh my goodness, I think there were two types and you had to have rubber mallets to get them on. So I think things like that play a part. And this is, again, going back to taking everything into consideration. I know as a hoof geek how obsessed and how that can become the number one priority to look at the feet. But looking at the bigger picture, so like I say, for me, I just am resigned to horses without the best frogs in the world. But for me, it's more important that they're out moving around and able to, cover distance and explore the terrain a bit more. So just balancing all these things out, I think, is always really important. And knowing what's ideal. I mean, that was a big thing with the equine podiatry training. The first year we spend learning about normal feet, healthy feet, and then that gives you this sort of baseline, this understanding of good foot, you know, good foot anatomy, good function, because then you can go into pathology and then you can recognize the difference. And I mean, certainly in behavior, I believe that's missing. You know, we go straight into domestic horses, which generally are showing sort of behavioral signs of stress and various things going on for them, and we don't have a baseline. You know, that's the value of studying free living horses. They give us a template of who horses are, and I think that really, you know, ties in really well with the feet. It's like, you know, what's ideal, but then you take in all the considerations around their lifestyle and your own limitations or abilities to work out what's the best way forward. And we we've got so many options that we can develop now, and there's lots of exciting possibilities. And I think that's something that is wonderful. I've seen the barefoot world just explode, and yeah, it's so exciting.
Yeah, and honestly, I think one of my flaws is that I tend to assume that all hoof issues are something else other than the actual hoof. So it's funny. I mean, I almost have to remind myself to focus more on the feet sometimes, because I'm always talking to people about diet and movement and environment and gut health and stress and, you know, herd dynamics and that kind of thing, over actually what to trim, because mm-hmm. I think that if you have a horse that's thriving, they're going to grow a healthier foot, and mm-hmm. we can't make up for that by just removing something on the bottom of the foot.
I agree. Yeah, absolutely. I think that the longer I spend looking at feet and working with horses, the more I realize I don't see that many actual foot problems. Like you say, it's symptoms showing up in the feet, and when you do get a foot problem, it's so easy to fix. You know, it is just trimming the right shape or whatever it might be. But this is the thing to consider, and I think this is the difficulty or a challenge for people when they take their horses barefoot. They don't quite realize. I think, you know, you get the feet looking good, or you get the right trimmer and off you go. But there's so much to unpick and unravel. And I mean, I'm always describing feet as the barometer. They're just telling us what's going on for the horse. And that's part of the picture. And it can be a very useful part. And I think probably one of the best signs that we have. And I think shod horses, we miss a lot just because there's so much covered up by the shoe. So I'd rather know what was going on and be able to adjust accordingly than just not be aware of things in the first place.
Yeah, and I'm the same way. I mean, I think that the feet are like that check engine light, and instead of just, you know, putting a sticker over it and assuming everything's fixed, you know, you're kind of investigating. And so I like that instant feedback that we get when they're able to feel the ground. And I guess one last question, and obviously it might be one that you can't really answer, but that's okay. We don't have to go into it if you don't want to, but you know, knowing that there's so many different ways that feet can look for a sound horse, do you or would you change your trim based on the environment?
Yes and no. That's a bit, sorry to be a bit vague. I'm trying to think of different scenarios. I mean, first of all, I guess separating out whether these are free living horses or domestic horses, that would be a big thing, because sometimes just getting a bit of length off a free living horse's foot is enough, and in fact an amazing thing that you can even manage to do that. So it wouldn't necessarily be about shaping the foot so much. But with a domestic horse, trying to help them get back to some sort of functionality. But I mean, the trim plays a part in that. So, you know, I'm thinking of a horse with contracted heels, or, you know, heel tenderness atrophy and at the palmar part of the foot. You know, using different surfaces, comfortable surfaces, putting them in boots and pads, things like that, encouraging them to use the foot in a way that is going to build up strength over a period of time, which the trim can play a part of, is a big part of that. But it depends what you have the capacity to do. So I think, yeah, the answer would be it depends. As my dear friend Jane Hunt used to say to just about every question she was asked.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I have a hard time answering that too. And actually, it's why I don't give any trim advice remotely or in general, because I feel like I make my trim decisions when I see the horse and I pick up the feet in person. It does get really tricky.
That's so important, and I think you know, as people are becoming more aware of what goes into keeping horses barefoot and horse care in general, you know, we've definitely, I hope, I'm ever optimistic, but I think we're on a positive trajectory of taking horses' needs into consideration, you know, not just what we want from them. And I think being able to piece, I often use the analogy of putting together this puzzle, this jigsaw of all the different elements that is going to be different for different horses in different places, and being able to support the owners and help them find the way that that's going to work for them and their horses. So I'm the same, you know. I mean, what can you tell from a static photo? What does that tell you? All of us can make judgments on the angles and the shape and the color or whatever it is we might want to talk about, but we have to see the horse moving, where they're living, what the history is. All of these factors have to come in. And, you know, that's one of the joys of being an EP, is that, you know, the extensiveness of the training, the depth that you go to. You know, when I first qualified, I was, you know, couldn't look above the feet. I thought it was all about the feet. And then very quickly learned that it's the whole horse. And certainly for the association that I'm a member of, the Equine Podiatry Association, a whole horse approach to hoof care is our tagline, because that encapsulates this, what this is, the feet, the trim. This is our main focus, and this is what one of the really tangible things that we can look at. But actually, we're going to look at every element of the horse's life and see what we can do to help in a big picture way.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. And those are the main questions that I had. I don't know if you have anything else that we didn't cover that you really wanted to speak to that you think is important to kind of get out there.
I'd quite like to say a little bit about the Equine Podiatry Association, if that's okay. That's
sure.
Quite an important thing in the UK with the sort of politics that go on.
Oh, yeah, of course. Right,
yeah. Yeah, so as I said earlier, when I started out as a trimmer, it was a bit of a fringe thing. There weren't many of us, and we had in general quite a bad reputation because, well, yeah, I won't mention any names, but there was a vet doing some pretty extreme things with feet. And a group of us decided that we needed to show the commitment and standards that we were reaching. And we formed the Equine Podiatry Association back in 2006. The idea being that in the UK, we wanted to develop a professional credibility to show we reached and maintained a standard. We have to carry on with 40 hours of CPD a year. We do lots of shadowing days. It's an incredible network of trimmers. So this hive mind of that you can tap into as a resource is amazing. But after a lot of hard work of getting a recognition in the UK, finally a couple of years ago, we became the first UK registered barefoot trimming recognised qualification, which was wonderful. I mean, it took so many hard years of hard work from really dedicated people. But just to show, again, the commitment of this, because I don't know about you in America, but certainly in the UK, you can get accused of doing a weekend course and being a trimmer. So we wanted to be able to show that the commitment and dedication we put into this. I think it's really important, you know, if you're looking for a trimmer to look at the credibility and the professionalism. I think word of mouth is a really good thing, but there's so much to it. You want to know that the person you engage, you can trust and is going to do what's best for your horse. And you can very often tell that just from the first conversation. So, I mean, it's wonderful to have been invited here, and you're doing such good work and interviewing such interesting people doing amazing things as well. So it gives this sort of broad view, this broad range that we can look at. I just feel like I'm waffling on now. So
No, thank you. I really appreciate that. And as you were talking about the program over there, I mean, I do think it's so important for hoof care providers to be a part of an organization that has, you know, they can have accountability of others. They can bounce ideas off of others, because it can be such an isolating profession.
Yeah,
but also absolutely. Because, you know, there's always so much. I mean, like we said, I'm humbled like every single day. Every single day I pick up a foot and I feel like I learn something new or learn something I can improve on. And I do think that these organizations are amazing. And adding to what you said about a weekend course, I went through, and I'm still a member of Progressive Hoof Care Practitioners, and it took me years to finish. I kind of wanted to dispel that myth too, that, you know, there are many of us that are just striving to always learn more and make sure that we're doing the best we can for horses. So I agree with you on that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so important. And I think this idea of support of each other as well, you know, there's so many people in so many places doing great stuff, and being able to link that up and have conversations is really important. There's enough divisiveness in the world. And I think if there's any way to be able to, I mean, ultimately we're doing it to help horses, aren't we? So, you know, let's help each other on the journey with that.
Right, exactly. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being willing to chat with me today. And I really appreciate your perspective, and it's been so interesting. If people were interested in getting in touch with you, what's the best way that they can reach out to you?
Okay. So, well, thank you for inviting me here. It's been really lovely to talk to you. And I feel like I could, we've just started a conversation. It would be great to talk more about feet. I have a website called, my business is called Touching Wild. And I also have just launched an online course called Through the Eyes of a Horse. It's a 12-week program. And the idea is to give people this blueprint, this baseline of who horses are. I also co-run a learning opportunity called Learning Wild, where myself and Dr. Emily Keeson, who's an American research scientist studying affiliative behaviours or friendship between horses, we take groups of people to remote places to study free-living horses and ponies all over the world. And again, just this idea of immersing yourselves in the lives of these animals to learn about horse behaviour, I think it's the most important thing that we can do, and it's an amazing experience. So Learning Wild and Touching Wild are my two businesses. And I'll send you the links so you can add those to the page for people who are interested to read more.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. This was great, and I'm really excited to have connected with you.
Okay, amazing. Thank you. It's been lovely talking to you.
You too, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.
You too.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
I always say that I'm slightly more hoof obsessed than the average person, and chances are, if you're listening to a hoof care podcast, you are too, so we should probably be friends. Feel free to find me on Facebook or email me at thehumblehoof@gmail.com.